The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome once again to The Heretics Hour, live right
now. Hello.
Yeah, hi, Don. We hear you. You hear me? Don has got a problem. We've had a problem here with this call. I don't know. Let me continue my intro, and we'll see what we can do about it. Welcome to the White Heretics Hour, ladies and gentlemen. It's Monday, September 23rd, 2013, and I just want to remind you that this year is the 100th anniversary of our United States monetary policy being handed over to the private banking cartel called the Federal Reserve System. I am Carolyn Yeager, and I have a guest tonight, none other than Don from California, but it appears that Don is not hearing anything. Even though I have a connection he's shown as on the line, I hear him. You can hear him, I'm sure, but he is not hearing us, so I have to go to the Skype page, and I have to move around here a little bit. I hope I don't screw anything up. She says, what happens is
hello.
That, yeah, Don, I'm here. You need to, let me find him. I have to send him a Skype message if I can find him on here. Well, I don't find him. This is really ridiculous. See, this is why people are supposed to call in when I tell them to call in early enough. Here he is. So that any problems that we have time to fix them, not call in at the last minute. Can't hear anything he says. I say, okay. Don, the show is on and I hear you. We
hello.
Hear you.
Okay, I'm here now.
You hear me
can
now?
You hear me?
I can hear you.
Hello?
Yes, hello, Don. Do you hear me? Obviously, you don't hear me, but you tell me you do hear me. What are you listening to? Are you listening to the feed? To the program? Keeps going dead. Well, I don't know what the problem is. It's not my problem. Yes, you can call in on the landline, but you have to hang up this Skype call. And you never have, you have to hang up the Skype call if it's not working and call me.
Hello?
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. I'm talking to him and he can't hear me. Yes. But hang up this call. Call first, then call the show number. Okay, he says. All right, so let me get back to, let me see if he's doing it. What is it? Jeez. And people really prepare, don't they? No, wrong. It's 443. Gosh. 443. You got that? Well, let's see if he hangs up the Skype call. Not so far. I can hear him doing his thing there. He's, it's undisclosed number. Well, I'm going to try answering this, even though he hasn't hung up his other call, his Skype call. What's wrong with people? didn't work. Is he the one that his phones don't, his two? I think I've got a block on undisclosed numbers. Oh, I'm doing it on the wrong place. God almighty, this is impossible to write and talk to him, and then I have to get back to the white network. Okay. There he is.
Hello.
Hello.
Am I coming through?
Yeah. You hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Who is this?
Who do you think it is?
I don't know. I was supposed to call in and do the Truth Militia tonight. Did I get the right show, or am I at the wrong
number? Are you kidding, or are you going crazy? Yeah.
What?
Not very funny, Don.
Okay. Well, so much of my career as a stand-up comedian.
Attempt of humor there. Okay,
yeah.
Well, I've got you both on Skype here and on your phone call, but it doesn't seem to be harming anything. So,
yeah, Skype isn't going through for me, so I don't know what the problem is. I need a new computer guy.
Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, we've finally started. We've got some listeners who were hanging on to see how this crazy business would end, to see if it would work out. So we're ready to get started now, and we've got Don, who doesn't, we don't use a last name for Don, from California. And Don, you've been with me before, but the last time was, I've looked back and found the last time was a year ago. It's just about exactly a year ago. And you were on the Saturday afternoon show with me, and I titled it "Can White Racial Consciousness Prevail?" It was, I think, September 28th or something like that, 29th of last September, and we talked about the after effects of the Trayvon Martin case. Can you believe it was that long ago? A year ago? That must have been when the murder took place, I mean, when the killing or when the death took place or something, but not.
Well, no, actually, I was on after Sandy Hook. I talked about the shooting, and that was in December.
But we talked about Trayvon Martin, I put in there, and I wouldn't have gotten that.
We talked about Trayvon Martin, but the Sandy Hook did not occur until December of last year, so that's less than 1 year.
Yeah, well, we talked about Trayvon Martin, and we talked about the slavery issue. That's what I had in there, the mentality of those on both sides of the slavery issue in America. And we talked about the non-credibility of the Barack Obama persona as sold to us by the media. And other times when you were on my program, it was when I was still on Voice of Reason, and I didn't go back to those shows. But I know that one was about the Constitution. And so these are your areas of investigation, which you pretty much, you know, stick with in our developing your ideas in. And so tonight it's going to be about what I said. It's going to be about your ideas about using language to call things what they're not and so on, right?
Yeah, exactly right. Before I began my great legal career, I was in college and I had kind of a deadbeat girlfriend who didn't show up for a court appearance out here on a traffic matter, and as a result, a warrant got issued for her arrest, you know. So I get this call one night at about 1 in the morning, and she says, you got to come and bail me out. I'm down at the Sybil Brand Institute. I said, the Sybil Brand Institute? What the hell is that, you know? She says, I'm at the Sybil Brand Institute for Women. And I said, okay, give me the address, blah, blah, blah. So I said, I didn't exactly understand why she would need to be bailed out of an institute, but in any event, I got down there. It turned out it was the women's jail, you know. They don't call it the women's jail. They call it the Sybil Brand Institute for Women. And it,
what's
it didn't
Sybil
occur
Brand?
To me.
Huh? Sybil Brand? What does Sybil Brand mean?
Yeah, Sybil Brand was some powerful political person.
Sybil,
yeah. It was some woman, some powerful political person here in Los Angeles County. And they built a county jail, and they named it after her. But they didn't call it the jail. They call it the Institute for Women. You know, it's like, as you go through life, you find more and more, nothing gets ever called by its real name. You know, down in Orange County, they call the courthouses down there justice centers, which is, if you know anything about Orange County, it's a complete joke. The last thing you'd get in some place that's called a justice center is justice. And it's kind of a trademark of the modern world. You know, before the Civil War, and we talked about this once before, when we had slavery, it was called slavery. You know, they didn't mince words. It was called slavery. It wasn't called uplift for black people or civilizing the heathens or anything like that. And when blacks ran away from their masters and tried to escape to the north, and the southerners, notwithstanding their belief that the slaves were all happy and contented, asked Congress to pass what were called fugitive slave laws. And they were called fugitive slave laws. They weren't called Civil Rights Act of 1853 or something. And when the Dred Scott decision was issued in, I think, about 1857 by the United States Supreme Court, this was an issue that dealt with whether or not a slave owner could take his slave into free territory, whether the slave would instantly be emancipated by operation of law, or whether he would continue to be the property of the slave owner. And, of course, the Dred Scott decision so famously ruled that a slave owner could take his property anywhere he wanted, and that black people had no rights that any white man was bound to respect. So, you know, however brutal, however oppressive, however unjust slavery might have been before the Civil War, at least they called it slavery. They called it what it really was. And I'm kind of an amateur Lincoln scholar. I used to be quite an admirer of Lincoln. And to some extent, still am. He was an extraordinary man, very gifted intellectually. He was a very brilliant intellect, and he was a great writer. His prose is really quite astonishing. Mm-hmm. And some years ago, I acquired a copy of the 8-volume collected writings of Lincoln, the famous Rutgers University collection. And it's online, but I tend to be more into physical books, and so I got a copy of it, and I read through the whole thing. You know, I read all of Lincoln's known writings, and I followed his speech, and I followed his prose, and how it developed. And something quite extraordinary happened to Lincoln in the time period between when he was elected in 1860 in the fall, in the very famous presidential election. There were four candidates. There was John C. Bell and John Breckinridge and Stephen Douglas. I forget who the fourth candidate was, but in any event, it must have been Lincoln because he was ultimately inaugurated. But so you read through there, and through his speeches, he's very loyal to the whole concept of the Declaration of Independence, our nation's founding document. And the two basic premises are, one, that people are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, and two, that governments derive their just power from the consent of the governed. And Lincoln called this the right of revolution. Now, interestingly enough, Lincoln was a fierce critic of the Mexican War in 1848. And this was a war that was fought, of course, with Mexico, and with a result that the United States increased its size enormously. The western part of the country was largely uninhabited. The Mexican War was very short. It was a few major battles, very minor loss of life. Nevertheless, he was a very strict critic of this war, and he gave a number of speeches in Congress. He was an anti-war congressman. He gave a very interesting speech in January 1848 when he was in the United States Congress, and he talks about the famous right of revolution, which is rooted in the American Revolution and set forth in the Declaration of Independence. And as we all know, the basis of the American War for Independence is that the people simply said to the monarch of the British Empire, "You no longer have consent to rule us, and in accordance with natural law, we're going to assume among the powers of the earth, the right to be free and have our own country." Well, Lincoln was a great admirer of this, and in 1848 in Congress, he made the following statements as part of a very lengthy speech. I'm just going to quote a couple of sentences of it. Quote, "Any people anywhere, being inclined and having the power, have the right to rise up and shake off the existing government and form a new one that suits them better. This is a most valuable, a most sacred right, a right which we hope and believe is to liberate the world. nor is this right confined to cases in which the whole people of an existing government may choose to exercise it. Any portion of such people may revolutionize and make their own out of so much of the territory as they inhabit. More than this, a majority of any portion of such people may revolutionize, putting down a minority intermingled with or near about them who may oppose their movement. Such a minority was precisely the case of the Tories in our own revolution. It is a quality of revolutions not to go by old lines or old laws, but to break up both and make new ones. So this was what he proclaimed in 1848, that it is a sacred right of people to rise up and change their existing government. In 1852, something kind of interesting occurred. He was out of the Congress by then. He was a member of the Whig Party during this time. The Republican Party didn't come along until about 1854. But Lincoln was a very active Whig in the state of Illinois, and in 1852, something kind of interesting happened in Europe. There was this huge event, the dispute between Hungary and Tsarist Russia. And a popular leader named Kossuth came to the United States, and, you know, he was trying to drum up support for the United States somehow to intervene and come down on the side of Hungary insofar as its disputes with Tsarist Russia are concerned. And so way out here in the prairie states of rural Illinois of 1852, this group of Whigs gather, and they talk about and they promulgate a list of talking points, a resolution on behalf of Hungarian freedom. And these were drafted by Lincoln himself. And the most important one is resolve number one, that it is the right of any people sufficiently numerous for national independence to throw off, to revolutionize their existing form of government and to establish such other in its stead as they may choose. This, of course, is consistent with the principles of the Declaration of Independence and consistent with the speech that I just quoted from when Lincoln was in the Congress in 1848. Now, they had a whole bunch of other points here, and they said the United States has a right to intervene, but we're not going to intervene. And it's very interesting, and about a week later they supplemented, and they said, it is the duty of the United States not to do any act or lay down any principle in regard to non-intervention that shall prevent this nation at any time from interfering in favor of any people who may be struggling for liberty in any part of the world when the proper occasion shall arrive. Now, it's kind of an interesting thing, because you think of what they're doing here is they're saying America reserves its right to intervene. Now, you know, we think of interventionism. We always think of these bankers in you know, the halls, corridors of power in New York City plotting to get us involved in imperialistic wars so they can profit off of them. But this is a handful of comparatively, you know, unknown people sitting out in the prairie state of Illinois in 1852 talking about having this heated debate over whether to intervene or not to intervene in a dispute between Hungary and Tsarist Russia. Now, the first question is, why do they care all that much, first of all? Second of all, what realistically did they think we could do? The last person who tried to intervene in Tsarist Russia was Napoleon Bonaparte, who, I think it was 1812, he marched into Russia with 500,000 men and marched out with a mere handful. And in light of his comparatively unsuccessful venture into Russia, I don't think it would have been terribly useful for the United States to get involved. But the point is, you see the beginnings of this kind of this pathology of America, and I guess they call it American exceptionalism, where somehow it becomes the duty of America, or at least America reserves the right to go anywhere it wants to go in the name of liberty and freedom and democracy. If you regard that, it's kind of like a precursor to the rhetoric we heard in the beginning of Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II, more recently in terms of Iraq and now Syria. There's talk about we have to go there and keep this guy from killing innocent civilians. I'm sure we're all familiar with the rhetoric. In October 16, 1854, Lincoln gave a speech in Peoria, Illinois, and this is the time when the Kansas-Nebraska issue had come to life, and they talked about popular sovereignty and whether the people in the individual states could decide the slavery issue. And this inflamed passion, because even though the people in the North weren't that keen about abolitionism, at least at this point, and they really were not keen about having blacks come into the northern states, they were very fearful of the idea that under popular sovereignty, slavery would be able to spread. And Lincoln made a statement. He says the people of Nebraska, he says Judge Douglas, this is Stephen Douglas, a person with whom he famously had the Stephen Douglas, the Lincoln-Douglas debates in 1858. They were political adversaries for many years. They even courted the same woman. Stephen Douglas courted Mary Lincoln before she became Mary Lincoln, which shows you what a small world it was. He says Judge Douglas frequently, with bitter irony and sarcasm, paraphrases our argument by saying white people in Nebraska are good enough to govern themselves, but they are not good enough to govern a few miserable Negroes. And Lincoln says, well, I doubt not that the people of Nebraska are and will continue to be as good as the average people. I do not say the contrary. What I do say is that no man is good enough to govern another man without the other man's consent. I say this is the leading principle, the sheet anchor of American republicanism, our Declaration of Independence. So Lincoln affirms the right, the importance of governing by consent of the governed. And then something very interesting happens. He gets elected in 1860. And in the months between his election in 1860 and his inauguration in March of 1861, you go back and read his speeches and his correspondence. There's kind of an interesting change that goes through with him. He talks about the Revolutionary War and how he read it and the lives of Washington and how it impressed him as a young boy. And he says, I recollect thinking then, even though I was, that there must have been something more than common that those men struggled for. I am exceedingly anxious that thing which they struggled for, that something even more than national independence, that something that held out a great promise to all people of the world, to all time to come. And this was February 21, 1861. This is about 3 weeks away from his inauguration. February 22, the next day, he's writing a letter. And he says, I have often inquired of myself what great principle or idea was that kept this Confederacy, that's the United States, so long together. It was not the mere matter of the separation of the colonies from the motherland, but something in the Declaration giving liberty not alone to the people of this country, but hope to the world for all time. It was that which gave promise that in due time the weights would be lifted from the shoulders of all men and that all should have an equal chance. That is the sentiment embodied in the Declaration of Independence. Now, notice the change here. Initially, the Declaration, by its plain language, says governments derive their power from the consent of the governed, and Lincoln has proclaimed that any people large enough to form their own country have a right to do so. Now, it's been transformed from a proclamation of the American Declaration of Independence to a so-called promise to all the people in the world. So we see this kind of universalism evolving in Lincoln's thought very, very suddenly after his entire life. On March 4, 1861.
Well, what do you attribute this to something? I mean, you say what took place that caused him, or did he get a larger image of himself as a world leader or something?
Well, there's a couple of more citations I want to read.
Okay,
that are comparatively brief. And then on March 4th, 1861, this is after seven states have seceded, he's delivering his inauguration address. And out of the blue, he says, I hold that in contemplation of universal law and of the Constitution, the union of these states is perpetual. Perpetuity is implied, if not expressed, in the fundamental law of all natural governments. Completely, the complete opposite of everything he previously said. And then he also says in that same address, it follows from these views that no state upon its own mere motion can lawfully get out of the Union. It resolves that ordinances to that effect are legally void. on July 4th, 1861, and this is the last quotation I'm going to read. This really kind of is the frosting on the cake, and astonishingly enough, this is Independence Day, July 4th. This is a special joint session of Congress. He says, "At this, this issue embraces more than the fate of these United States. It presents to the whole family of man the question of whether a constitutional republic or a democracy, a government of the people and by the same people, can or cannot maintain its territorial integrity against its domestic foes. It presents the question whether discontented individuals, too few in numbers to control the administration, in any case can always, upon the pretense made in this case or in any other pretenses, arbitrarily break up their government and thus practically put an end to free governments upon the earth." Well, he says, "The sophism is that any state of the Union may consistently with the Constitution and therefore lawfully and peacefully withdraw from the Union without the consent of the Union or of any other state." So by July 4th of 1861, he's done a complete intellectual U-turn. He has completely flip-flopped. He has gone from governments derive their powers from the consent of the governed, ultimately to the premise that governments derive their powers from the conquest of the governed. He has gone from the premise that liberties are the inalienable rights of men to the premise that he says that the Union, by conquest or purchase, the Union gave the states whatever of independence and liberty it has. So no longer is liberty an inalienable right that is derived from the Creator, it is derived from the Union. This is a complete transformation of the founding principle of this country, that governments derive powers from the consent of the governed, to the premise that governments derive power from the conquest of the governed. And of course, the rest is history. You know, he waged a genocidal, aggressive war, an imperialistic war against the South, a looting and raping expedition that inflicted tremendous property damage and human suffering on the people of the southern states. It is the great irony that this war, supposedly waged to free slaves, actually ended up enslaving free men.
Well, but now, do you have any explanation as to why he changed? He wasn't already considering doing what he was doing at this point, was he?
You know, this raises a great issue in my mind. And what happened to Lincoln between his election and between the opening months of 1861, prior to his inauguration, and then up until July 4th, 1861? It would be really interesting to see his appointment calendar and his correspondence to see who turned this guy around. Because within a very short period of time, he completely turned around. And this is the essence, in my mind, of the Civil War, is that it completely transformed this country and completely abolished its founding principles. The war, and if you look in terms of history, the Civil War was really an imperialistic war, and it was the first of several imperialistic wars. But insofar as the theme of the program, which was the use of language and calling things something they are not. Notice that he talks about the threat to free institutions of all mankind. I mean, this is not just a threat to dissolve the Union insofar as the southern states are concerned. He describes this as a threat to dissolve the entire Union and smash the entire country, and indeed to destroy the hope of freedom for all mankind and the whole world forever. I mean, where have we heard this rhetoric more recently?
Yeah, I was just going to say, that's the same rhetoric that we have in the World Wars.
World War One, World War Two, the Cold War, Iraq, my God, Saddam Hussein, if we don't go over there and bring this guy down, he's going to come over here and take our freedom. So what was a regional conflict, a very limited conflict by people who simply wanted to go their own way and exercise the prerogatives of the Declaration of Independence and resolutions that he himself had drafted, now suddenly becomes, they're going to destroy all of humanity. So we see this kind of megalomaniacal expanded notion of, you know, this almost this pathology of the rhetoric of freedom and liberty and democracy, which is used as a cover, as a description to describe something very different. Mm-hmm. And it struck me, that's the way that it struck me, and I wonder what your reaction is to it.
Well, I was looking up before the program, I was looking up slogans for World War One and World War Two, because I knew you were going to, you know, you covering the Civil War very well, and how that, but, you know, there's two of them for the Great War, which became World War One. I thought one of them was for World War Two, but they're both World War, the First World War, the War to End All Wars, and then the War to Make the World Safe for Democracy. Those both are considered Wilsonian things.
Well, in a very real sense, they're also Lincoln-esque as well, because Lincoln made, under different language, under different vernacular, of about 70 years before, or 50 years before that, he used essentially the same argument. Remember the famous Gettysburg Address? You know, we're here, I forget the exact words of it, you know, 67 years ago, blah, blah, blah. But the final sentence of it says, the purpose of this is to determine if government of the people, by the people, shall perish from the earth. So he's transformed this into, you know, a border dispute, you know, a dispute between people who want to go their separate ways into a great global conflagration. And there was a global dimension to the Civil War. The South had planned for many years, going back at least as early as 1820, to form that if they were to succeed, they would form an alliance with Great Britain, and they would use that as a means of securing their independence. There's a very famous diary entry by John Quincy Adams from 1820. He was the Secretary of State. I forget who the president was in 1820, but John C. Calhoun, the very famous United States Senator from South Carolina, was the Secretary of War, and they were talking. 1820, of course, was the year of the famous Missouri Compromise, where the whole issue of the spread of slavery into the West exploded into the issue of, what was Missouri going to be admitted as a slave state or as a free state? And, you know, states are admitted, they're admitted in pairs. You bring in one slave state, one free state, so that the balance of powers is maintained there. And of course they drew a line horizontally across the United States, and they said slavery will forever be excluded from north of this line. And the Kansas-Nebraska Act in the 1850s, to which I earlier referenced, was an attempt to get rid of the Missouri Compromise line and say slavery can go anywhere if we can get the votes, which is a problem for the Southerners because they didn't want their slaves counted. They wanted their slaves all counted as citizens for the purpose of congressional representation, but of course they didn't want them to vote. Hence, you had the Three-Fifths Compromise come about. But in any event, Calhoun and John Quincy Adams were discussing the Missouri Compromise and the issue of slavery and the volatile nature of it. And they talked, according to this diary entry, they talked about secession even then. And they said, if the South goes, the South will reach an alliance with Great Britain. And because Britain was heavily dependent on Southern cotton even in 1820, 40 years before the Civil War. Well, as it turned out, that's exactly what they tried to do. The British Empire sent troops to Canada to invade the northern states. Lincoln countered that by entering into an alliance with the Tsar. And so the Tsar got his ships out of their ports in Russia and sent them to San Francisco and New York City. And the Tsar sent a message to the British government that if you come in on the side of the Confederacy, we're going to come in on the side of the North. Our Navy is going to be deployed against your Navy. And it could easily have ignited into a world war. Also, remember that very shortly after the Civil War began, the French invaded Mexico and occupied that country. They put Maximilian on the so-called throne of Mexico. I mean, whatever that means. You know, ultimately, the interesting thing about that is that the South pinned its hopes on for survival on recognition by the British and the French. The so-called Maximilian government pinned its hopes on recognition by the Union, by the northern states. And they actually offered the northern states, the northern provinces of Mexico in exchange for diplomatic recognition. Now, the Lincoln administration and the Johnson administration thereafter refused to do that. They respected the sovereignty and the independence of the Mexican people. Kind of a story that's been swept into the dustbin of history. When Mexican sovereignty was threatened, we stood by Mexico, and of course Mexicans care not a whit for our sovereignty today. But it is an interesting kind of a footnote to history that the southern states were relying on European powers for recognition and for survival and legitimacy, and then their reoccupation of Mexico while the United States was locked in a civil war. They were relying on the anti-slave northern states.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a digression there, but excuse me. The point I wanted to make is that this was a war that was really a very limited war that was characterized by Lincoln and his efforts to get to legitimize it morally and to get political support for it by characterizing it as the Confederacy is going to come out of here and rule the world and smash free institutions and freedom of the people of the war for all times. When in point of fact, it was the Lincoln government that suspended habeas corpus in the North, put 300 northern newspaper publishers in jail, shot 1,000 northern citizens who were protesting against the draft. It wasn't dirty, rotten southerners who shut down northern newspapers or shot northern civilians or put, you know, anti-war dissenters in jail. It was the Lincoln administration itself which clothed itself in all this noble rhetoric of making the world safe for freedom and democracy and so on and so forth. And you see the same kind of... And, of course, the South was crushed, and you see this enormous corporate, commercial, economic power. And I believe that was really what was at the root of Lincoln's decision to go to war and crush the South. The South provided essentially the funding for the Northern government through the tariffs of the manufactured goods that it imported from Europe that were subject to tariffs, and they could not let this cash cow escape from the Union. It certainly wasn't because they cared about slaves or humanity. Interestingly enough, the same Abraham Lincoln and Ulysses S. Grant was also very much against the Mexican War on moral grounds, notwithstanding that he served in the United States Army in it. Ulysses Grant said countries are bound to be punished for their sins, and he said the Civil War was the punishment of the United States for what, quote-unquote, we did to Mexico. I mean, like we did anything to Mexico.
Who said that? Ulysses Grant?
Ulysses Grant. This is a man who savagely waged war against southern white people, but he had a soft spot in his heart for the Mestizos, just like Lincoln did. I mean, this is so weird and so screwed up. You could hardly make it up. It's almost like today, you know.
Well, go ahead. Finish.
It's almost like during the Cold War, you had all these liberals who were so anxious about voting rights for blacks in Alabama. And I said, when I was a college student, I said, what about voting rights for white people in the Soviet Union, you know? Why don't you ever call for democracy in the Soviet Union or Cuba? And, of course, the reply was, you're a racist, you know, racist, sexist, homophobe. Well, they didn't say that in the 60s, but you get the gist, mm-hmm. You know. So you see all this kind of weird, kind of intellectual and emotional weirdness in Lincoln and Grant and some of these Northerners. I mean, they had this soft spot on their heart for these Negroes and these Mestizos, but they had an absolute hate on for the white people of the South. And it was unusual for Lincoln, because Lincoln had always been very conciliatory. You follow through his speeches in this area, and he said, you know, the Southerners are no different from us. If the situation were reversed and we had slavery, we would not easily rid ourselves of it. This is a hard thing, that history is against the South and slavery is going to have to go. He made very clear that the Civil War was not about ending slavery, even though it ended up that way, but that he wanted to hold the Union together. And there were some good reasons for his doing that. But nevertheless, under his own proclamations and under the doctrine of governments drawing their powers from the consent of the governed, the Confederacy was perfectly legitimate. All of the states seceded based on ordinances of secession passed by their legislatures and signed by their governors. The South had a right to go.
Yeah, but so, it's obvious he didn't want that to happen. And so, you know, he wanted So, see, breaking up the union was something that was not going to be acceptable. And so they used, but before that, he could have treated the South better. I mean, he could have treated the people of the South and their issues and so on more reasonably, and that would have held things together. But, so how much did the discussion and the disagreement about slavery actually play a part there? Must have played some role.
Played a huge role.
Yeah.
I mean, it was not the existence of slavery in the South. It was the spread of slavery to the West. And you know, even if the South had been allowed to go and the Civil War hadn't broken out when it did, it's probable there would have been a clash over the ability of the Southerners to take their slaves into the Western states. And that's what Jefferson Davis wanted to do. There was endless talk about that. And the South felt that it was being cheated out of equality under the Constitution because of this prohibition from their ability to take slaves into the Western states, the Mexican Cession, and the northern part of the Louisiana Purchase. So, I mean, these Southerners, I mean, I'm no great admirer of the Southern aristocracy and the leadership. They should have had the sense to realize they were on the wrong side of history. And that slavery was very harmful to rank-and-file white people. It was not good for rank-and-file white people. And rank-and-file white people in the northern states, particularly in the midwestern states, they had Illinois, Lincoln's home state, actually had laws that forbade free black people from coming in to the state. They didn't want them there. And Lincoln himself said he wanted the western states to be free from slavery so that they could be opened up for working white men. Lincoln was a colonialist. He believed that the slaves should be returned to Africa, and he believed that very firmly until his death.
Yeah, I know he did. And what stopped that? What got in the way? Who was in the way of that?
Well, his being assassinated stopped that. I think Lincoln would have been far more lenient in his treatment of the South than the South was ultimately treated by these crackpot radical Republicans who were virulently anti-white. They were virulently anti-white. You talk about the Northerners, interestingly enough, they could be talked about in lenient, merciful terms and gracious, humane terms because toward the blacks, because they didn't have any blacks. Basically, they only had a handful. And it's very interesting to note that as the blacks migrate out of the South to the North, what do you start seeing? You start seeing race riots. In Chicago in 1920, there was a huge race riot. Mm-hmm. This is from, the land of Lincoln, the great, great emancipator. And if all these white people in the North love blacks so much, why did they so strongly have so many racial problems? Of course,
people don't love these people. They love the ideas. They have, like you said, they didn't have hardly any blacks there, so they could think, all these idealistic thoughts about them, humanity and so on. They just love their ideas. But if they have to actually experience the downside of these ideas, they don't want to reject. They don't want to then reject it, but then they run away or they try to get away from it.
Well, they try to, and that brings us to the second point that I wanted to make. The first point was that in the Civil War, we see this use of grandiose language to try to call a war something it really isn't. It was a civil war. It was a war between one part of the country that wanted to break away from the other. And here, Lincoln has falsely characterized it both for his contemporaries and for history as this great, galactic struggle between the forces of freedom and these dirty, rotten slave owners, like they're going to come out and conquer the whole world. I mean, they couldn't, Washington, D.C. and Richmond, Virginia are practically next door to each other if you look at a map. And throughout the Civil War, the Southerners couldn't occupy Washington, D.C., so they're going to conquer the world?
Let me draw an analogy before you go any further into your sentence.
Sure.
Besides, something I had thought about earlier when you're talking about it being a simple border war and turning border wars into some kind of world events, and makes me think of the war between when Germany went to war with Poland or invaded Poland after all that took place ahead of time, all the difficulties with coming to any agreements and so on. And then the United Kingdom or Great Britain at that time, decided to enter, had just shortly before that, had made this treaty with Poland, saying that they would support Poland and they would, you know, defend her if anything happened. And so then they entered in and turned it into a huge issue and turned it into a world war, when it could have been solved between Germany and Poland. Of course, it would have been to Poland's disadvantage, but that was their own fault and what they deserved. So but they wouldn't have been treated so badly because Germany had a good plan and just wanted to get Danzig and gave a lot of guarantees to the Poles and assurance that they would be able to continue. No, Germany wouldn't interfere with their continuing to be a sovereign nation, you know, and all of that. But that wasn't good enough for them because they saw themselves gaining more through an alliance with Britain. And that's what put that, you know, built that all up to what it was. And then Deanna Spingola, she talks about civil war fairly often. And she hates Abe Lincoln, but she says that that was the first total war, you know, that presaged the World War One and World War Two, which were total wars, especially World War Two, where she says you target the civilians. What do you say about that?
When Genghis Khan went west from Mongolia, he depopulated entire regions. He went to Baghdad, and I believe it was 1284, flattened the complete city, killed every living thing except for the insects, and caused the Baghdad Caliphate to flee west to Turkey, where it became, to Istanbul, where it became the Ottoman Empire.
Well, maybe this could be the first
total
war in the West.
Well, this was the first industrial war, where you had railroads, the telegraph, and many of the modern things. Actually, a lot of ancient wars were far more destructive, and I mean they just exterminated people. But yeah, she's right. This is the first modern war. Predicted it would be over in a matter of weeks, and of course it went on for years. And then you had people who predicted the World War One would be over in a couple of battles in a few months, and it went on for many years, and many, many millions of people were killed, and the whole map of the world had to be redrawn. But
so, that was on purpose? I mean, do you think that these wars could have ended, but somebody made sure that they didn't? Or was it just once things get started, you can't stop them?
Well, it's very interesting. There's a guy named Walter Page. Walter Page was an ambassador. Walter Page was a personal friend and confidant of Mandel House. In fact, Walter Page takes credit for introducing Mandel House to Woodrow Wilson. Page was a member of a publishing house. He was a Southerner. He was one of these progressives, and he was appointed to be the ambassador to Great Britain after Wilson was elected. And he was ambassador there for the first couple of years of World War One. And in 1927, after his death, the so-called papers of Walter Page were published, three volumes. And I got a set of those, and I was reading through them. And you read this stuff, and sometimes it can be very infuriating. And he talks about America was not involved until 1917, of course, but he was very much an Anglophile, very much affiliated with and he wanted America into the war. He was very dismissive of Henry Ford and very contemptuous of William Jennings Bryan, who was the Secretary of State, who was trying to end the war. They definitely wanted this war, and he made it very clear that the goal of the war was the annihilation of Germany. And he talks about the threat of Prussian militarism. You know, there's never any discussion about British militarism and how they got the biggest empire in the world, you know. But Prussian militarism, and he goes through this whole thing, it builds up inside of these people. There's kind of a pathology there where they believe, in a manner of speaking, they believe their own bullshit, you know? It's like the Southerners who believed the slaves were happy and contented, but they had to go to Congress for fugitive slave laws to keep them running away. Well, in Walter Page's book, he talks about the repeated attempts of the German government to stop the war. peace overtures. And every single time he writes about a peace overture, he is more and more angry and more furious at the Germans. By God, those dirty, rotten bastards, they're trying to bring this thing to an end. You know, we're not going to let that happen. We are going to wipe them off the face of the earth. So we're going to save the world from the scourge of Prussian militarism, blah, blah, blah. Do you know when the first German peace overture came through? October of 1914. 90 days after the shooting started, the Germans were trying to make peace.
They never wanted the war to begin with.
They participated in it, but in any event, what is the narrative that we hear about World War One? Well, I collect old history books, and one of the books I got was an American history textbook, and in the cover of it is written somebody's name and Virginia Military Institute, and published in 1925 or 1926. And you compare that alongside the books, the papers of Walter Page, completely different. According to Walter Page, the Germans were trying to make peace from October 1914. According to the conformist textbook, by God, the dirty, rotten Germans are trying to conquer the world, and we had to go to war to save the world. You know, who writes these books? It's like there's some kind of parallel universe or something. You know, there's the conformist version of history for the masses, and then you read the diaries and the correspondence. And David Irving's a genius at this. I've really learned a lot from David Irving about the importance of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, in fact, that's how I stumbled onto the papers of Walter Page. And he quotes a letter of Mandel House that said Germany only did what they had to do under the circumstances. Germany was forced into the war. So, you know, this book was published in 1927. It won the Pulitzer Prize. So this is not like some hidden diary that was concealed from the world. These rulers actually proclaim their megalomaniacal kind of pathology to the world, but somehow it seems to go unnoticed. I think that's kind of an interesting aspect of it. But that's consistent with the whole thing about World War One being called something that it really wasn't. It was called a world to make the world safe for democracy and blah blah blah. Democracy was never threatened.
No.
Except in India, nobody was really that cool about allowing the people of India under British rule to have democracy. We didn't hear much about that. We didn't hear much about the people of Ireland getting any democracy when they were very harshly occupied, very harshly treated under British rule for hundreds of years. Between 1850 and 1900, the population of Ireland dropped by 50% as a result of famine, epidemics, and migration. You know, the blacks are always talking about slavery. You know, the worst crime against humanity and all their weeping and wailing. Well, if you look at the demographic figures on slavery, the slave population continually increased. There has never been a decrease in the African-American population in this country. From the late 1700s, the Revolutionary War period, they were about, I think, 700,000 to, I think, 4 million at the time of the Civil War. Their percentage of the population from 12 to 16% stayed pretty much the same. It all we hear is how the poor blacks were treated, but never any sympathy for the poor Irish, right. who many millions of whom were killed under British rule.
Well, was the talk about slavery as extreme back then during that time as where we're now told how they were whipped all the time and the women were raped.
Well, I mean, a lot of them were treated pretty badly. I mean, I'm not defending slavery necessarily, but I think it's interesting that if you study the population figures, the numbers continued to increase. Mm-hmm. So how badly could they have been treated if their numbers continually increased, you know? I think most of them were treated not that badly. The interesting thing is you didn't really see any slave uprisings. If you compare slavery in the south of the United States with slavery, say, in Haiti, it was very – in slavery in Haiti, I mean, that was really brutal. Torture, whippings, floggings. See, in America, they ended the slave trade fairly early on. That was written into the Constitution. That was the first real blow against slavery. is the end of the slave trade, and that was a very significant thing, because if people couldn't simply cheaply replace slaves, there was an incentive to keep them alive and treat them well. If you could simply replace them cheaply and easily, then what did you care? You work them 18 hours a day, and it was called working them off. And in Haiti, when they had in 1790, at about the time of the French Revolution, 40, I forget the numbers on the island, there was a tiny percentage of slaves and tiny percentage of white people, and, you know, they were outnumbered by 10 to 1 by blacks, but 40% of the black population in Haiti had been born in Africa, which means they had been brought into the country. On slave trading. I mean, by the time we had our Civil War, I mean, there were no blacks here that were born in Africa.
Okay. Now, are we going to get, you're going to get into, in the next hour, into how we're calling things what they're not and bring that up to date with civil rights,
civil rights
and all of that
civil
stuff.
Rights yeah, atrocity.
That's really interesting. I know you've got a lot to say about that. So,
civil rights is the new slavery.
Okay.
By another name.
Okay. And so is there anything more? You know, we've still got a few minutes here. Oh, we are hearing the, we've got 60 seconds. Okay. So what would you like to leave us with in this first half, Don, and before we go to the break?
Well, I think the Civil War was the first aggressive war, imperialistic war that this country fought. And it's a tragedy that the North won the way it did, because I think there is a straight line from its victory in the Civil War to its involvement in the Spanish-American War and the two world wars, which basically consist of ruling the people of Germany and other conquered peoples without their consent.
Okay. All right. And go ahead.
Complete violation of the founding principles of this country, that government derives its power from the consent of the governed.
Okay. Well, we will be back in after the musical break in 5 minutes, ladies and gentlemen. So hang on. And Don, stay on your phone. Don't hang up your phone call.
Okay.
Okay. And everything's going great now. So we'll see you in 5 minutes, ladies and gentlemen.
Sie liegen im Westen und Osten, sie liegen in aller Welt, und ihre Helme verrosten und Kreuz und Hügel zerfällt. Sie liegen verscharrt und versunken im Massengrab und im Meer, aber es leben Halunken und die ziehen noch über sie her. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Sie waren nicht ausgezogen um Beute und schnöden Gewinn. Was heute verlacht und verlogen, es hatte für sie keinen Sinn. Sie hatten ihr junges Leben nicht weniger lieb als sie. Heute Höhnen es hinzugeben, sei reine Idiotie. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Thank you. demonstrieren, mehr Freizeit bei höherem Lohn. Sie mussten ins Feld marschieren, der Vater, der Bruder, der Sohn. Sie gingen die Heimat zu schützen und haben allen entsagt, was kann uns der Einsatz nützen, hat keiner von ihnen gefragt. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Und welche Erbärmlichkeit.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Heretics Hour. On September 23rd, 2013, I'm here with Don from California. We are talking about war propaganda language that distorts our thinking and carries on after the war. And we've been talking about the Civil War mostly. And before we go on, Don, I want to take this opportunity to thank some contributors to the White Network. I have a little list here. I don't want it to get too long. So since the last time I thanked our donors, I want to thank William, Gloria, James, Kevin, and Robin. Thank you all very much. It's really important what you do, and we do appreciate the support. So, Don, where do we want to go from here?
Well, I want to talk about the Civil Rights Movement. The Civil Rights Movement, and I mean that body of laws and judicial decisions, pretty much commencing with Brown versus the Board of Education in 1954. I think that's really kind of the founding event. In many ways, the most evil aspect of the Civil Rights Movement. The Civil Rights Movement is in reality the new slavery, only they don't call it slavery. The intellectual honesty that existed before the Civil War is gone. And this is one of the problems. This is what has made it very difficult for white people really to fight back or to resist what's being done to them or even to understand it. Because it's called, you know, civil rights. I mean, who could be opposed to that? Equality. I mean, who could be opposed to that?
Would you say that the Civil War led to civil rights? I mean, it's kind of a cute word thing.
Well, the Civil War was in many respects the first blow against the existence of white people. I mean, the war, it was not an explicit war against whites, but clearly the purpose of it was to subjugate southern whites and forever rule them without their consent. And to make them second-class citizens. Now, obviously, under slavery, the blacks were on the bottom, and that was wrong. It was wrong. They should have been brought here. It was a violation of their right of freedom of association and freedom of contract to enslave them. You know, it's a horrible tragedy, but I don't think payback is the answer.
It's just not the only place in the world it ever took place. That's the thing. I mean, it's going on in a lot of places in the world, but the only slavery you hardly ever hear about is in the United States South during that short period of time.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I read Barack Obama's memoir, Dreams from My Father, and he talks in there about him in the early 20th century, I think, you know, 50, 60 years after the Civil War. He talks about how his African grandfather purchased an African woman for the price of 15 cattle. And I wonder what Southern racists are going to blame that on, you know. They're still buying and selling each other in that continent. In some cases, they're still eating each other. So, you know, they need to look to their own
well,
problems.
Yeah, as I've said, I know this is not probably a good argument, but as I've pointed out, you wouldn't find a single one of these black people who trace themselves back to slavery to have to decide they would rather be in Africa than where they are. So it was a boon to them in the long run that brought all those Africans over here to this continent, to this nation, and where they're now living quite well. Well, they never
would. Well, that's, I agree that the blacks alive today are very fortunate that their ancestors weren't taken to Haiti, or certainly not to Arabia or any of the Muslim countries. A huge number of slaves were taken to those countries, and they were treated very, very harshly. You notice in the Middle Eastern countries today, you don't have populations of black people, and that's because the black slaves that were taken there were basically, they were castrated, they were neutered, and they served as slaves or objects of sexual gratification. But you don't see any survivors around today, or at least very, very few, which should tell you something about the kind of treatment they received. The Muslim slave trade took. There was a black historian from some British college, I forget his name, but he said that of the slaves who were taken to the Middle East by Arab slave traders, approximately 3/4 were women. Of the slaves that went to North America, 3/4 were men. So you can figure out what the purposes were in the relative, the mixes of genders. I mean, women, you don't want women to necessarily work out in the fields. You want men for that task. So slaves weren't sent to the Western Hemisphere for sexual gratification. They were sent there to work, which is a slightly more humane aspect, but. Getting up to date with the Civil Rights Movement was not about achieving equality or social justice. The purpose of the Civil Rights Movement was to create a new racial caste system in this country by elevating blacks to a superior legal status as a creditor race and lowering white people to a subordinate legal status as a debtor race. If you read the Supreme Court decisions, the jurisprudence on that, you read books by black intellectuals, they're always talking about the unpaid check, the unpaid IOU that America owes black people. And that means the subjugation of white people, and it means the transfer of white wealth to blacks. And one of those first extraordinary, which I think was one of the most extraordinary blows struck against white people, was Brown versus the Board of Education, which authorized the integration of so-called white schools. First thing you have to realize is that there's no such thing as a white school. There are schools with white children, with white human beings. In 1896, there was a United States Supreme Court case called Plessy versus Ferguson, which said that the government can have racially segregated facilities if they were separate but equal. And that is the source of the saying, separate but equal. Okay, blacks can have their own schools if they're funded the same way and they have these other, other facilities. And there were even lawsuits brought in the pre-Brown versus Board of Education to try to equalize funding and equalize facilities and all these kinds of things. And that's another, there's a whole body of history there which is not particularly relevant here. But separate but equal was destroyed by the holding in Brown. What Brown ruled.
And when was this? What was the date on Brown?
Brown versus the Board of Education was handed down by the United States Supreme Court in 1954.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
And this was a Republican Chief Justice appointed by a Republican president. A Republican president who dispatched the United States Army to Little Rock, Arkansas, and other locations to force political change on the American people at gunpoint and bayonet point. The people of this country, when they've been given the chance to vote on segregation and integration, are always opposed to it. You know, I'm old enough to remember the 50s and the 60s, and we have segregated schools because people liked it that way. Mm-hmm. You know, they did. They really did. And I want to read one part of Brown versus the Board of Education, a single sentence. And this is where they formulate the issue and they formulate the basic holding. It says, the question presented, quote, does segregation of children in public schools solely on the basis of race, even though the physical facilities and other tangible factors may be equal, deprive the children of the minority group of equal education opportunities? We believe that it does. This is a 14th Amendment case decided on the grounds that racially segregated, denied black children equal protection of the law. And so what they've held here is that the mere separation of black children from white children deprives black children of equal educational opportunities.
Yeah.
So what is the opportunity of which they are deprived?
Yeah, being around white people.
In a segregated school. What is the opportunity?
Being around white people.
The compelled physical presence of white children. The Brown versus the Board of Education decision vested black people with property rights in the physical persons of white children, and it forced public school districts, in addition to providing buildings and textbooks and teachers, to maintain inventories of captive white children to be passed around like livestock.
Well, you see, they found quickly that the black kids couldn't do what the white kids could, and the black people, black adults, couldn't either.
I'm sorry, your voice trailed off. I didn't get that.
Oh, that you hearing me now?
Yeah, yeah.
I pushed my mic for back because I thought maybe I was being too loud. All right, they find that the black people, the black students, let's just stick with the schools, cannot succeed as they think they can if they give them equal education opportunities and so on. And it's the same way in all society now. They are, you know, what's happening now with HUD saying every neighborhood has to be integrated with black people. You can't have any all-white neighborhoods. They're going to force it. Because black people, when they're amongst themselves, they cannot live up to the standards that the white people do. And so they have to be some black people around quite a number of white people for them to, pick up on that and do better. I don't know if they actually do better, but they don't do better because when we integrate the schools, the black students are still doing more poorly, but they can't explain this according to their liberal theories. So therefore, they just keep trying to integrate the people. I think the plan is to miscegenate. I think the plan is to get these blacks and whites together enough so that they'll get so used to each other that they'll start, mingling sexually more than they ever have. And then you will upgrade the black people by putting more white genes into them.
That's one theory, but the interesting thing about the Brown decision is that it vests one race with property rights in the members of another race. When did we have that in this country? We had that prior to the Civil War. That was the whole premise of slavery. But it's even more evil than slavery because there was no constitutional right to slaves. Okay, being black didn't automatically make you a slave. There were plenty of freed blacks. There are no free whites under Brown versus the Board of Education. The next point I want to make is that under slavery, there was no constitutional right to slaves. If you wanted slaves, you had to buy them, you had to inherit them, you had to win them in a poker game, or you had to get them in some fashion. Or I guess if you owned slaves and they gave birth, you had new slaves. But they elevated the possession, the physical presence, the compelled physical presence at gunpoint, if necessary, as we saw in Little Rock, Arkansas, to the level of a constitutional right. Now, under the First Amendment, you have a right to practice a religion, you have a right to freedom of the press, and under the Second Amendment, you have a right to keep and bear arms. But in no instance is there a constitutional right to a government-supplied church, a government-supplied printing press, or a government-supplied firearms or gun collection. This went even beyond that said there is a right to government-provided white children, the physical human beings.
Okay, so there's a constitutional right for blacks to be around white people.
To have the compelled physical possession of white children. And it is a duty of school districts to maintain inventories of captive white children. That is the evil of Brown versus the Board of Education. It basically enslaved white children to blacks and indentured white children to blacks. And then what happened when you had slavery of black people? Certain black people ran away. Fugitive slaves, right? Fugitive blacks, runaway blacks. you had fugitive slave laws to keep them, to try to keep them from running away. Well, what happens when you enslave white children? What happens when you impose tyranny on white people? White people run away. That's called white flight. And if we all know what white flight is. Black people don't want to live around blacks, and they run away from them. They don't want their kids to go to with school with blacks. They run away to the suburbs. You read this. It's very interesting to read about white flight through the prism of the United States Supreme Court decisions. There was a black justice named Thurgood Marshall who wrote a number of opinions in these cases. And there was a case in Michigan that was kind of an interesting case. They tried to deal with white flight called Milliken versus Bradley. I think it was in the, 74. And what happened is, you had the big race riots and the blacks were burning down the cities as part of their civil rights movement. We'd call it domestic terrorism today, but of course you can't say that about blacks because they're frustrated. And it's not fair to hold them to the same standard. But in any event, all the white people moved out of Detroit. There weren't any more white people left. So, they couldn't maintain an inventory of captive white children. So what did they try to do? They tried to throw their net over the surrounding suburbs. Mm-hmm. And this is a very famous decision. And the Supreme Court, thank God you had some Republicans on there who said, we can't let you do this because the suburbs, many of them didn't exist. And they're not guilty of any segregation. And they can't be punished for past sins. Kind of a weird decision.
Decision? I'm not clear on that. What was that Supreme Court decision?
Milliken versus Bradley. This is 1974.
What did they say that had to happen?
Well, they said if people ran away from Detroit and they ran away to suburbs, and in some cases they founded new cities and new school districts, the Supreme Court said, look, you can't throw a net over these runaway fugitive white people. They didn't call them that, but they... that's clearly the meaning. They said, look, these suburbs were never guilty of discrimination.
Oh, they were defending. They were defending the flight.
No, they found that it was not a violation of Brown versus the Board of Education for white people to run away.
Okay,
they said it wasn't a violation to run away. The white people could run away and they could start new school districts. And they said, look, some of these suburbs are never guilty of discrimination or segregation, so you can't really punish them. I mean, the whole idea is really weird. It's like, certain white children can be punished, but other white children can't be punished because they ran to a new area and started a new school district. I mean, it's just the most weird thing you ever read. And Thurgood Marshall writes a dissenting opinion, scathing a opinion. He says the rights at issue in this case, and remember, that is the right to the compelled physical presence of white children, captive white children, are too fundamental to be abridged on grounds as superficial as those relied on by the majority today. He thinks they should be able to chase down these white children and throw a net over them and integrate them with these suburbs. And he talks about a right that is too fundamental. That is the right to the possession, of the physical possession of white children. And the courts have dealt with this problem of white flight, various things. But there's an interesting case I wanted to mention because it really shows the absurd lengths that they have gone to deal with the problem of runaway white people. And remember, runaway white people are analogous, in my view, to runaway blacks who ran away from slavery. In Lindmark Associates versus Willowboro, there was a town in Virginia, and they tried to stem the tide of white flight by forbidding the posting of for sale signs and sold signs. They actually passed an ordinance that said if you were going to list your house for sale, you couldn't put a for sale sign on it. And if it sold, you couldn't put a sold sign on it. I mean, how ridiculous and screwed up is that? Well, the Supreme Court struck it down on First Amendment grounds. They said, you're going to have to solve the problem of white people running away by some other measure. We can't let you interfere with free speech rights. They decided this on a First Amendment basis. I mean, the idea that there's no moral objection to the idea of enslaving white children. I mean, we can't go that far. But here we got, free speech. I mean, how are we going to, we have to fight for free speech here. But that's how ridiculous the war against runaway white people became. They actually tried to forbid the placing of for sale signs and sold signs on residential property. I mean, you read this stuff, and if you've got any sense of objectivity at all, it makes you want to, go out and start a civil war or something. I mean, it's just really, really infuriating. And then in Marshall wrote an interesting dissenting opinion in the Bakke case. There was a case called Bakke where some white medical students sued. It was an affirmative action case in a medical school. And in Marshall writing for in one of the opinions in that case said, the differences in the experience of the Negro make it difficult for me to accept that Negroes cannot be afforded greater protection under the 14th Amendment where it is necessary to remedy the effects of past discrimination. Okay, greater protection under the 14th Amendment means they're elevated to a superior legal status, and white people to a subordinate legal status. This is a racial caste system.
Okay. Makes sense.
White people. So this is how you argue. Now, we talked about my theory of white advocacy. And my theory of white advocacy, the first principle of white advocacy is you call things what they really are. You know, you don't call this the Civil Rights Act has nothing to do with civil rights. It's the new slavery. It is a racial caste system that is erected by stripping white people of their rights. And the Civil Rights Act of 64, which forbade racial discrimination in housing and in commerce, stripped white people of their rights of freedom of association and the rights of freedom of contract. Prior to that decision, I mean, you basically, one of the essential elements of a contract for hundreds of years was the element of mutual assent. The parties had to agree. And if one party achieved the assent of the other party by fraud or by force or by coercion, I mean, if it was a child who didn't have the legal capacity to contract or some old person who had dementia, didn't have capacity, or if you lied and perpetrated a fraud, that nullified the contract because there was no valid mutual assent. Well, now, blacks don't have to get mutual assent from white people. All they have to do is go in and demand to be served. The same with homosexuals and Hispanics and the whole litany of these so-called minorities. They are elevated to a superior status. They can simply override the white right of freedom of association. We can't form voluntary groups. We can't form white student unions. We can't form, here in Los Angeles, there's something called the black newspaper, the Sentinel. How the hell do you have an all-black newspaper in an era of civil rights when discrimination in housing and in employment is supposedly illegal? I read the newspaper on a fairly regular basis, and they had an advertisement in there by a self-described black law firm for black people. I think it was for estate planning or living trust or some crap. Do you know what would happen to me if I had a white law firm? I would have a state bar on my back. I would have the Department of Justice down my back. These laws are selectively enforced.
Do they not accept non-black?
Well, sure, they'll accept white people. I mean, they take anybody's money, but the point is, they get to have their own newspaper and call it an all-black newspaper. All the writers are black. All the editors are black. The whole staff is black. How do they get off doing that? They get off doing that because they are a superior, they have achieved a superior legal status. They can do whatever the hell they want, and nobody is going to call them on it.
Well, how do we do something about this? You know,
the first thing is you call things by their real name. You call civil rights the new slavery. You call the enslavement of white children what it really is, the enslavement of white children. Illegal immigration is another example of calling something a name that it really isn't. It is not immigration at all. It's an invasion of our country by foreign people. They came here, they occupied us, and they have the legal ability to force American citizens to provide them with food stamps, free education, free health care, all sorts of things. Now, traditionally, a conqueror went to a country and exacted tribute. Mm-hmm. And what should this be called today? It shouldn't be called social welfare. It should be called tribute. And when the American citizens in California in the 1990s passed Proposition 187 to try to cut off public services to these parasites, the rulers of this country said, sorry, you cannot deny your conquerors the right of tribute that is theirs by right of conquest. Now, I didn't use those rules, but that's exactly what it is. If foreign nationals can flood your country and take your property and physically occupy your real estate and take money from you and take the product of your labor, what are you if not a conquered people?
Don, you should write a series of essays on this that are real clear and easy for people to understand and follow. And then we should have an effort to post them, you know, and print them all around as many places and get that out to people. Because, you know, you have some really good legally based arguments, but they're not getting out to people. And if it all comes at once, it's kind of hard for people to.
I agree. I'm working on an idea for a book on this. The title of the book, one of the working title I'm working with, is called Blind No More. Yeah, I was for many years a colorblind conservative, the operative word being blind. And when you get through that and you become racially aware, you're blind no more.
Yeah, but you know what I think?
That's kind of the theme, and that's the first thing white people have to do to survive is to take off the blindfold and be blind no more.
Well, right, but you know, a lot of people are saying that, but what you have that nobody else has is that you can present these things in a legal way. And this idea about white slavery and so on, if you know, if it's explained, it really makes a whole lot of sense. And if you don't put, you know, if you wait till you get a whole book, it might be more than people can handle. But if you'd write some of this in essays, you know, maybe like you said tonight, might be, you know, make up three or four different essays that people can, and we could get them out to people so we could start to see in more concrete, these concrete terms, well, maybe I should say legal terms, how we are being misused and abused and treated unfairly while we're being accused of being the ones who are doing that to others.
You're absolutely right. You absolutely characterized it. Mm-hmm. We're being we're being dispossessed, ethnically cleansed, and ultimately we're going to be exterminated. And that's the amazing thing about it. Under slavery, which has this horrible reputation, and perhaps, you know, justly so in one sense, but under slavery, black numbers continue to increase. Under civil rights, white numbers are dwindling. I mean, under social justice and equality and civil rights, we're headed on a path to extinction.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if that is not the greatest example of calling something something that it really isn't, you know, civil rights and social justice, hell, it's genocide. And that's what it ought to be called. It's slavery and it's genocide. These Mexicans can come here and strip us of our wealth. They can steal our jobs, steal our tax dollars, and steal our children's future. What future do? There was an article this weekend in the Los Angeles Times about a family, a white family, and you got three generations living under the same roof, and they've all lost their jobs. They've got, you know, BS, part-time jobs. They're scraping and dying, you know. And this is like some norm. You know, there ought to be an uprising. There ought to be people in the streets, and people just read and say, oh, okay, well, you know, I got to work harder and find two more jobs that I can work because, as it is, I'm sleeping 10 hours a night, and maybe I could make do with only 5 hours and work another job, you know?
Well, how would you answer the statement that is made that these people coming here are just looking for equal opportunity?
Well, Christ, if I walk into your house, do I get a chance to have equal your dinner? You have a duty to feed me the same dinner you feed your family?
No.
Well, where does that crap come from?
Yeah, well, that's the kind of thing I like to say, too.
You know, I mean, one of the things I noticed from Lincoln had an interesting approach to slavery. If you read his prose prior to his becoming president, pretty good stuff. He discusses slavery, and he said to people, he says, I hear white people talking about the blessings of slavery, yet they never volunteer to become slaves. You know, I thought that's kind of an interesting position. And when I find people who talk about the blessings of illegal immigration, it stimulates the economy, I say, fine, when are you going to give up your American job to an illegal alien so that you can enjoy the blessings of dispossession and unemployment and poverty? And, of course, none of them do. They get very mad. They call me a racist, blah, blah, blah. But you have to personalize this. You have to know how to shoot for the heart.
Mm-hmm.
You really have to know how to argue it, and white people don't. They just, oh, okay,
no, but
equality.
I get back to the fact that if you'd write this out in clear ways in a few essays, and I would definitely post it and help get it as many places as possible, then you could teach us, you know, we could be taught how to argue this, how to talk back about this, because Otherwise, we don't know. People don't know. They don't know how much grounds they have to stand on. They don't know that this is, you know, how to point out how unfair, not just unfair, but, you know, just how basically, well, what's the right word for it? A big swindle, you know, it's a big swindle.
It is a huge swindle. It is an intellectual swindle, a financial swindle. It is the swindle of the life of a people. It is a swindle of the life of the white race. You know, when you mischaracterize things by calling them things they are not, it's like counterfeit money. You know, I give you $100 bill and you think you've got $100 and you part with $100 worth of labor or merchandise and you end up with nothing. You gave away value and got nothing in return. And that's the significance of the political and the intellectual swindle that is being affected on the American people. They are giving away their lives. They are giving away their countries and the futures of their children. And they're getting nothing in return except phony bullcrap, you know? Phony bullshit platitudes about democracy and the world and equality. You know, these Mexicans, we come here to work. You know, they didn't come here to work in the 1800s before the welfare state. They didn't come here to work then.
Yeah.
They only came here in the late 1900s and the early 2000s when the welfare state was firmly established. You know, when you had food stamps and public education and the county hospital and aid to financially dependent children. I handled a criminal case for a lawyer friend of mine one time. It turned out the guy was an illegal alien who was arrested for breaking into cars. I'm reading the guy's pretrial probation report before his preliminary hearing. Guy's got 6 kids with 3 different women, plus a wife. They're all on welfare. That's 9 people on welfare. How is that a boost? Huh?
No, I don't want to interrupt you, but I've got an article here that I posted on my notes about the rising illegal immigration again. Before we go on, let me invite listeners to call if they want to comment or ask Don a question or, you know, discuss anything with him. The number is 1-830-443-4911, and you are welcome to call in at this time, and I'll take your call. So, you know, just today, there's something here that says the total number of, if this was an AP story, total number of immigrants living in this country unlawfully. Now, here's another way of what they're doing. Here's something I really noticed. They never say an unlawful immigrant. They don't say what's that word that they're using here? Illegal. They never write in the MSM, the illegal immigrant, let alone saying illegal alien. But now everything in this article, which I haven't been reading about this stuff lately, but everything in this says immigrants here illegally or some variation of that. The illegal always comes afterward so that they're not being called illegal. They're just here illegally. You know, the number of Mexicans here illegally. Immigrants in the U.S. illegally. It's just another way of changing how you react to what's being said. And it's edged up again because they think bad economy. And it went down some in 2000, between 2007 and 2009 because of the recession. And it's just slowly been coming up again. But it's not only, you know, but here they say they make it sound almost like when the economy goes bad, they all leave. They don't all leave. Only a tiny little layer on the top leave, and the rest all stay. They stay. And why do they stay? Because they've got all these benefits, and they've got
the
families
train.
Here. Absolutely, you know, and they've got. Let's see if there's any of that in here, but you know they get all kinds of stuff. They want to give them this college education and so on, and some states are giving them tuition breaks and driver's license rights and things like that, where some others they say are trying to tighten things on them. But again, they always call them immigrants rather than illegal aliens or just
invaders.
invaders.
They're invaders. Right. They're occupiers. Right. This is a foreign invasion and an occupation of this country. We are being looted and dispossessed.
And so there's another use of the language being used wrongly. You know, in a propagandistic way. And then they're not arresting people on the border like they did at one time. And it says that the migration path has been somewhat shifting. Who knows how much this is, but has been shifted somewhat from Arizona to deep southern Texas, due in part to Texas has the strongest economy in the country, I think. And increases in Central American immigrants who seek a more direct route to the U.S. And there's also some statistics here about where these, we got 5.65 million. This is, you know, of course, I think it's like double what they say it is, but they think it's about 12 million illegals in this country. Almost 6 million of them are from Mexico. And almost that many are from, 15% from Central America. And, South America, Caribbean, and other parts of Latin America are 12% of them are from there, and 10% from Asia. So, you know, it's just like nobody wants to get rid of these people. They're not really concerned about them. They want them here, but they just, you know, go through the motions.
The most incredible aspect of illegal aliens is all the black leadership is coming out in favor of amnesty. You know how Mexicans treat blacks here in California? They shoot them. They hunt their kids down and they use them for target practice. They call them niggers. They have no respect for them. And so how are rank and file black people benefiting from being murdered in their own communities? This has been going on here in L.A. literally for decades.
Well, they're stupid, and they don't know that if they destroy the whites, they're not going to have any kind of protection from other, you know, malevolent non-white peoples. They really don't.
I'll tell you something a black guy told me, a black real estate client, very interesting. We were talking candidly about this kind of stuff. And he said, you know, he's got a nephew. He calls him Mr. Black Studies because he took black studies in college. And he says the guy's absolutely worthless for anything except calling on the phone and, you know, asking to borrow money to pay his credit card bills. But he said, this whole reparations thing, he says, the Mexicans are going to say, look, you didn't pick cotton for us. You think you're owed for slavery? You go talk to the white man. Well, the white man's not going to be around. Mm-hmm. Where do blacks think they're going to collect their reparations?
Yeah.
They're just nuts. They're just nuts, you know?
Well, the whole thing is nuts. If you try to make sense out of it, it really doesn't make sense, except that's why we come up with conspiracy theories, because, you know, reasonably, there's no intelligent answers to all of this.
Well, the intelligent answer is there's been a decision made that white people are going to be replaced with non-white people. And it's not a conspiracy. It's pretty open. I mean, here in California, they make really no bones about it. Obama certainly doesn't. The leadership of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. I'll tell you, if anybody thinks the Republican Party is that much of a friend of white people, who gave us Brown versus the Board of Education? Who enforced Brown? There were huge numbers of Republicans who supported the Civil Rights Act of 64. Mm-hmm. Who gave us, you know, Hispanic Heritage Month? You know the president who signed off on that piece of crap? Ronald Reagan. You know who signed off on the first amnesty? Ronald Reagan. You know who gave us the Martin Luther King holiday? Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
He's like the Republican FDR. Huh?
Yes, that's true.
He's like a Republican FDR, and there's this horrible personality cult. It's like a church, you know, Ronald Reagan, you know, the great communicator. The guy was a fraud.
It's only that some of them seem like they were better in some areas than the Democrats are, you know.
Well,
but
he was
not
a Democrat.
Really... No, I know.
But Ronald Reagan delivered California to the hands of the Democratic Party. The Republican Party's never coming back. The Mexicans have completely taken over the state. It's just ridiculous out here. Mm-hmm. Just ridiculous.
Well, this is why I think that you're right. They want to replace whites, but when you look at the question, how are they going to succeed? And you know, as in their economy and in their culture and in their you know, as a national entity that way. That's why I think they're encouraging miscegenation, and they're encouraging whites and blacks to mix sexually so that they will lift, you know, make this kind of mulatto group of people who are basically good enough with, I suppose, the Jews running the thing from the top.
They want the destruction of white people, and white people are in many ways leading it, which is amazing.
Yeah.
I don't know how you deal with that. I have some kind of some good news, though, on another note. I want to change the subject a little bit.
Okay.
You know, this guy Craig Cobb, who's starting this colony in North Dakota and leaving North Dakota.
Well, is he starting a colony?
Well, okay. He's starting something.
He would like to.
He would like to. I'm not sure, but kind of interesting. There was a university student who did the North Dakota University school newspaper did a big horrible editorial about how terrible he was and how dare white people think they have a right to breathe, you know, and this kind of thing. And there were like 50 comments to it, all of them except there was one guy who responded to some of them. But other than the one person, all the other people were pro-white. And they wiped out the comments section because I guess it was too prejudicial. So they eliminated all the comments. I follow the comments on these black on white crime things and other racial issues pretty closely. They are overwhelmingly pro-white.
Well, that's because I agree. But that's, you know, the white nationalist type people are reading those stories and intentionally writing comments.
Well, it's more than white nationalists. There aren't that many white nationalists out there.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't believe in it. I mean, it's like every newspaper you go to, every website, there was a story, CBS out of New Jersey or New York, about some white man who was beaten to death by three black teens. I mean, they were called teens, but we know what that means. And it was posted on the CBS website, which is a pretty mainstream site. I mean, there are hundreds of comments. There were like two comments that were pro-black, and all the rest were white people. And they were virulently racist. I mean, 5 years ago, before Obama got elected, you would post stuff like that, and it would be instantly deleted. And now you go to websites, and there's hundreds of these comments. The Los Angeles Times, I read that every day, follow it pretty closely. There's this one of these black columnists who's always writing, you know, black stories, and she wrote some story about Trayvon Martin and how it was, I don't remember. It was so ridiculous. But she talked about, she says she hated to write stories about race because she knew her email box would be flooded with horrible comments from awful racist people. And it troubled her to think there were so many racist people around. And that means there is a simmering, boiling pot of anger out there. And it's getting worse all the time. I mean, I see it in people that I talk to and professional people.
I don't think it's real hopeful to think that it'll just explode and people explode helter-skelter. I think it needs to be directed, and I wish we had somebody who could direct what's this, you know, this simmering, boiling pot of
Well, it's got to reach critical mass, and the leaders will come forth. You never know where the leaders are going to come from. You're a leader. You're one of them. All like Mike Delaney, I listen to his show, and he says his numbers are way up. He's getting lots of good numbers. Harold Covington, the Northwest Front guy, he's getting a lot of good numbers and a lot more inquiries.
Jesus.
The people who lead stuff are really a small number of people, and when you show strength, the tide will turn. I mean, when you think about how hard they work to silence us. You know, you see people say, it doesn't matter what you say, it doesn't matter what you write. Well, it certainly matters to them, or they wouldn't try so. I mean, look at this guy, Craig Cobb. Who cares what he does in some one-horse town and, you know, some crossroads in Leithy, North Dakota? Well, apparently it's a threat to somebody because they're working awfully hard to silence him. I mean, they've hunted that guy all over the world.
Well,
the
Southern Poverty Law Center grabs hold of any activity by anybody to make a big deal out of it, make it seem like a big deal, in order to keep up their phony baloney about how white nationalism and white supremacy is a big threat to society and so on, you know. That's why they do that. And then they get the newspaper coverage for it, and the newspapers love this kind of thing too. So they play it up. But what's actually happening there, is not going to change much of anything. I don't think. I'm not saying it was a good idea to start with, but I think it's being mishandled now by turning it into, you know, bringing Jeff Shoup from the.
I have misgivings about him.
And just the whole idea of talking about Nazis, and I mean, it's enough that they call you a Nazi, but if you start talking about you're going to put swastika flags all around, and there are some, and even I just saw the latest there over at VNN Forum, and they've got this huge Confederate flag flying on his or somebody's property there. And, you know, why take a Confederate flag up to North Dakota? As though, you know, what are they trying to prove there? I mean, it just doesn't
work. I mean,
they're just trying to oppose these people.
You know, it's like you go up there and you poke them in the eye and kick them in the groin, and then you expect them to welcome you with open arms. I don't understand the guy's approach.
No,
he doesn't come off like a crackpot when he talks. He seems
he's
very
not.
Reasonable.
He's an intelligent person. He's a very nice person.
But to
take that kind of attitude, and you know, he makes a point that he's a creator, he's against Christianity, and they're all Christians up there, whether they think that much about it or not. But you can't, like you say, it's like kicking him in the groin and punching him in the face and then saying, well, how come you don't like me? I mean, that's not the way to go about it. So he just can't resist, I guess, doing things the way he does things.
Well, there's a lot of them on our side of it who like to act that way. And it's almost like they have there's this pleasure in being a martyr or something. I don't know. I don't understand it really. But
they like to insult people. So,
well, you know, you're in a small town and everybody hates your guts, and you know the county sheriff's gunning for you, and you know they're trying to nail you for everything they can. You know, building code violations and all that. It doesn't make sense to piss people off. It really doesn't.
No.
So I don't know. I don't know what his plan was. I mean, I admire his courage in going out and quote unquote doing something, but why make it the battle harder than it has to be? You know,
had a good plan, and he was there for a year, Craig Cobb, working and buying these lots. And nobody knew about it, at least, you know, maybe a few people. But then when he started talking about it and saying that he had given these, given some of the lots to these white, you know, certain white nationalist, well-known names and so on. Well, what happened was, the Southern Poverty Law Center found out and called him up, and he talked to them. And so then they posted this interview on their website, and it just ballooned from there, you know, and it was like, oh good, we're getting all this, media attention. This is good. But the media attention has not been used positively, it doesn't seem to me. And therefore, I don't think that there's going to be any future there. But, you know, there is a future in a place like North Dakota. I guess this oil, I wasn't sure about it, but I guess this oil and gas business from the fracking practices up there is there's a ton of oil. And there's a new life coming to the United States as being an oil producer again.
If they get the technology right, there's a way to solve our energy problems there. I think there's probably some environmental issues that need to be worked out on it. But
yeah, I guess there are people who are against it environmentally. But just speaking economically, you know, this is an opportunity for white people to get up there and get these jobs and so on. But the fact is that we're spoiled and we're not frontier people, and we don't want to go and live. A lot of these people, they don't want to go and live in North Dakota. You know, it's not nice there. They'd rather live in Southern California where you are. or they, you know, live wherever they are now and stay there. They don't want to, you know, and that was the whole thing, the way it started, was that Craig Cobb was, and others were saying, hey, you young guys, you know, go up there and join him and get jobs and buy some little property or take one of his little lots there. And you know, he was starting something good, but I think it's gotten out of hand. I think it's gone in the wrong direction.
Well, I think it'll die off after a little while. People get bored with it and they'll move on to something else. I just hope he can hold out and get his house brought up to code and stick in there. If he can do that, it'll be a victory. I mean, there's a lot of circus aspect to it, but, you know, so maybe that's what it takes. I don't know. I'm rooting for the guy, and, you know, it's too bad he's so vulnerable to all the political aspects of everything up there. And he's never going to be able to find a lawyer in that state that's going to help him. There's not enough lawyers, and nobody wants to get involved with him and lose their job and their career and everything. So that's one disadvantage to going to a very small state like that. It's hard to get somebody to help you out. But
well, I think, Don, that you have a real good thing going here with your ideas about the white slavery. And I think instead of looking at what other people do, I think you should get busy. I'm always trying to get people to get busy. You should get busy and write this stuff up and let me and other people know about it, and we'll get it out there, because I think this is a good, these are good arguing points, discussion points and so on that we can use. I think there's a lot of, there's something nobody else has thought about that I know of.
Well, I'll tell you, I've studied the Civil War for many, many years. I took a 400-level college class on it, and I've read it, and this kind of thing. I've never heard anybody point out these things in Lincoln's speeches where he flip-flops on these issues. I mean, I don't know why it was. I mean, it's right there. It's all public record. The idea that he goes from the right, you know, government deriving its power from the consent of the governed, and he just says, well, you know, you get your freedom from the union.
Mm-hmm.
Now screw you. We don't need your consent to rule you. And that's a pretty dramatic thing. All at the same time, he's talking about democracy and freedom and the Declaration of Independence. I mean, it's really in your face, and it's kind of remarkable that nobody's ever commented on that before, or at least nobody that...
Yeah. There you go. So you've got something original there, and I think it could be really, really helpful. And rather than wait until you get a whole book together, I think you should think about. And of course, I realize, and the listeners need to know, you still work. You work. You know, you're a working man, so you don't have all the time in the world. But you know, if you put it into, start out with these essays or something, it could be chapters in the book or something. And, you know,
right.
Then later put it all together as a book. But don't hold it out from us until it becomes an entire book. And if people don't have a hard time reading books anyways, you know, it's all we hear about now. People don't read. They don't want to read. But, you know,
I think they do.
I do, too.
I like
to read. But if it's not too long, you know, a lot of people can't handle starting something that's a whole book. So if you do it this way, I think it'd be really good. And be easier on you, too.
Well, you might be right. You might be
right.
Yeah,
well, I'm gonna harass you about it.
Okay.
Well, we didn't get any callers. I don't often get callers, so I guess nobody knows what to ask about it. But they have hung in here listening. So we've got now about 4 minutes left for the program. Don, you've done a great job keeping it going. Would you have any last-minute points you want to make?
Yeah, the key to survival is to call things what they really are, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's how they fooled us. I mean, it's even with advertising. It's the whole thing. Propaganda is making people believe often the opposite of what's actually the way it is. It's often just absolutely turned around, isn't it?
It is absolutely turned around, and You know, your show's on Germany, and you talked about how those people are really under the heel, and they've lost their free speech rights and a lot of their political rights, and they're basically an occupied country. And it occurred to me, what is that if not government without consent of the governed? I mean, you are so fearful of the people that you have to crush them.
Mm-hmm.
You have to crush their spirits and crush their free speech. And I think a lot of white nationalists really misread the importance of freedom. They identify freedom with pornography and, you know, all these things. And it's freedom that is the source of our prosperity and our happiness. It's freedom that's allowing you and I to really resist now. If we didn't have the freedom, there would be no resistance if there were no freedom.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a big lie that there's that Germany is the most democratic state in Germany's history, the one they have now, and things like that. It's all lies, you know. I mean, it's all, it's not just exaggeration. It's just plain dishonest and wrong. So, yeah, democracy does not it's not the way to freedom. It isn't.
Well, democracy is kind of a separate issue. That just deals with the way rulers are chosen. I don't know. I think the two-party system has failed us very badly. I think the whole banking system is really very much at the source of a lot of these problems. The ability of the Federal Reserve to simply create money out of thin air and go into the marketplace and bid against us. And I don't know, that's a hard one to fight. I think ultimately it's going to take a collapse. And when people, you know, we've talked about this before, and I think that ultimately the cities, the collapse may not be a bad thing for white people, because you know, I drive around LA, hardly see any white people. You know, Lethe, North Dakota may not be the most hospitable place, but at least the people are all white, you know.
Well, sure, you go up there, that's why it's a good place to start something, you know, for white people to go.
But you see, the point being, the cities are going to be very hard hit when everything really goes down the toilet.
Well, I'm not sure that's going to happen, because I think they have the ability to keep things going in some way or another, you know, and that life will just get a little bit worse, a little bit worse, a little bit worse, you know, slowly, and people will accept it. Because they don't have any choice, and I just don't see this big. I think we're hoping for something that's going to change everything. It's not really going to happen. Well, we're out of time. Don, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. I think it's been very informative for the listeners and brought new kind of ideas.
Enjoy doing it. I'll try to get my Skype sorted out next time.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you next time. Good night.
Good night. Hello.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.